Hi.
Hi, Sarah. April showers bring May flowers.
April showers bring May flowers. Yes. Sure. Do you hear the dogs in the back?
I was like, or barking dogs. God.
These dogs. None of these dogs, for the record, are my dog.
That's a lot then.
It's just a lot of dogs. And then on our block Google group, one of the like elderly neighbors got on the block Google group the other day and was like, what's happening with all these barking dogs? I hope everything is okay. And I use that tone because I know this person, and for sure that was the tone she was using. And she felt like she had to say, I hope everything is okay.
What she really meant is, can't you make everything okay?
Shut your dogs up, everyone. My dog is, for the record, very quiet. So, I mean, that is the one good thing about having this particular dog.
I support you. I support all of the people with dogs.
Well, I mean, mistakes were made. He is very sweet, though. He's warm and fuzzy.
See, that's nice.
I mean, it's nice to pet a dog. You were just saying that you went to Target. Tell everybody about Target. What's that like?
It's so weird. So everybody, Little Romance had volleyball, but it was like 90 minutes. So it's too long to go home and come back. So I was like, well, I'm going to go to Target because I am vaccinated and I've sort of run into Target and run out, but I have, yesterday I did the thing at Target where you just
lingered.
I looked at the books. I took a picture of Kate's book and sent it to her. I bought sports bras.
Perfect.
And then I bought new sheets and a new quilt for the bed.
It's such a treat.
It was. And I just was like, this is nice. This is
shopping.
Nice. Shopping. I know. What a wild thing to do.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I've done none of those things, but I get the jab tomorrow.
Yay.
I get the jab tomorrow.
So. Yay. Yeah.
Talk to me at 5 p.m. It'll be over, and I will want to take a nap, I think, probably.
I think that is correct.
Well, there is this. This will be the final test of whether or not I actually did, in fact, have COVID all those months ago when Kate Claiborne filled in for me, and you guys did six bed romances.
Ironically, yeah.
Because
are you getting the one shot, or are you going to get
no tests? I don't actually know. I'm going to, like, one of the big New York
super sites.
National Guard sites.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I'm going to go in. Some guy in a uniform is going to go stand over there, and they're going to put a needle in my arm.
Yes.
And then I'll have immunity.
It is a great feeling. It is. I haven't really changed. I will say I haven't changed my, like, life all that much, but
no.
I find that when I am places that before would have made me feel nervous, instead I was like, you know what? It's okay. I have my mask on, and I'm in Target, and I'm immunized. Let me look at these sports bras.
You had the Fauci ouchie.
I do hate that phrase, but
it's terrible.
You know,
but
it really is.
It's terrible, but it is a little catchy. And so periodically I find myself thinking, just like randomly, like, Fauci ouchie. That's funny.
Somebody's gonna make a jingle out of it.
AOC, LIT, RBG, RIP, CBD, ZZZ, COV, ID. Ouchie, ouchie. Ouchie, ouchie.
Can I tell you what's adorable? My daughter, in school, I don't know, like some school, obviously, like in school, they've talked about the coronavirus, and they have talked about Dr. Fauci. So she knows who he is. Like, he's done a couple of, like, he did a Sesame Street thing, and he's done, like, some videos for schools, like, to talk to kids about. Like, he basically is the guy. Like, the CDC is like, we don't have anybody else. We have this guy. We have this 80-year-old man.
He's our guy.
He'll talk to everyone. No matter how old you are, he knows what to say to you. So she was reading something. She brought home something from school, and she's in second grade. So she's like, for second grade, she's a great reader, but she still, you know, reads at a second grade level. So, like, she's looking at this piece of paper, and she goes, and then Dr. Fauci, said, blah, 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 because it's Dr. for doctor.
Of course.
So she's like, Dr. Fauci.
Sure.
And now I just can't.
Anytime that makes him sound like a German opera star. Dr. Fauci.
So now anytime I see any of our friends who are doctors, I just can't. Like, I have this, like,
sure. You're like
moment of, like, I want to just call you, like, Dermadel. Dergen.
Sure.
So anyway.
Welcome to Faded Mates, everybody.
Oh, yeah. Welcome to Faded Mates. I'm Sarah McLean. I write romance novels and I read romance novels. I turned in my book last week. The revision is done. The copy edits are done. Bombshell is coming.
Yay.
Wait, can I say this? I know.
Yes, keep going.
I hate saying this. You know I hate saying this. 3 years in, I hate saying it. But Eric was like, you got to say it at the beginning sometimes. You guys, I write romance novels. I have a book coming out August 27th.
Maybe you should check,
it's
Sarah.
Either the 24th or the 27th. Hang on.
You're like, look, getting it done is the first step.
August, whatever. That, now somebody else is involved in getting it on shelves. It's coming out August 24th. It's called Bombshell. It's the first in a new series called Hell's Bells. For those of you who don't know, I write historical romance. And if you have ever been listening to this podcast and thought, gosh, that sounds like a nice lady, I wonder how her books read.
They're terrific.
You should read them. Pre-order Bombshell at a bookstore near you. And thank you very much for your patronage.
I'm Jennifer Prokop. I am a romance reader and critic. And you know what I'm hoping? I'm hoping by the time August rolls around, you will be able to do some in-person events for Bombshell.
Maybe.
At, like, bookstores.
That would be amazing.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
Gosh, remember bookstores?
I have got to tell you already, Little Romance is going to go to college somewhere, and I am already going to be, like, reaching out to the independent bookstores nearby and being like, hi.
Hi.
Sarah and I are going to come talk about romance.
Wait, are we sharing where Little Romance is going to college yet?
We will as soon as it's, like, final.
As soon as Little Romance decides.
Yes.
But if it's where I think it is, like, I'm excited because there's an indie there that's great.
Yeah, and it's very close to
New York. Very romance friendly.
So I'm excited
also
about it, too.
Close to New York.
Yeah.
Which is the best thing for me.
Me too. I mean, I hate
Who
to
Who cares
way,
about this kid? He'll be fine.
I was like, look, can you go somewhere where I have a lot of friends? That would be what is best for me right now. So, yeah, as soon as it's for sure, he's taking his time and weighing his options. It is nice.
So this is Faded Mates, and we've talked about this a couple times over the last few weeks, but for those of you who are new, and there are many thousands of you who were not with us our first season, thank you for joining us, and thanks especially to our first season people who have been here for the long haul, long Faded Matesers. We started our first season intending only for 18 episodes that were going to be a deep dive of Cressley Cole's Immortals After Dark series, which we did. You can go back to the beginning and read Immortals After Dark along with us, and we think it was pretty fun. There is a lost limb count in the show notes.
Yeah.
We get very excited about vampires and how they drink their blood. It's very exciting. It's an exciting ride.
It is, and it's funny because, like, the lost limb count, we didn't start right away. And now I'm like, you know what? As a summer project, I'm going to go back and reread the ones without a lost limb count and make sure it's updated, make sure it's correct.
Sometimes people send us corrections.
I know.
And we do go back and enter them.
And they're right, by the way. I was like,
of course they are.
I did miss that person chopping off their arm. I don't know what I was thinking.
Actually, the truth is, you guys, when you send us tweets or DMs or Instagram messages where you tell us 1,000%, like, how we misread a scene in one of the Immortals After Dark books, Jen and I love it. It just gives us an excuse to go back and read again.
Absolutely.
Anyway, we, Jen and I, had never read...
That's right.
...this particular series by Cressley, which is her debut series, her first book ever, The Captain of All Pleasures, published July 2003, which is a long ass time ago in romance.
That would be right after I gave birth to Little Romance. Those were some dark years, pop culture wise. So I wasn't doing anything.
I was young and not very smart, making bad choices.
Here's the other thing. I'm going to say, I think this is the first time in three, however many years of this a podcast that we neither of us had read the book we decided on.
No. And we decided because I was finishing up copy edits on the book. And I was like, it can't be anything that like I really have to think too hard about. You know, it has to be something that like we know I'll just be able to cruise right through it.
Right.
So we decided on Captain of All Pleasures because Cressley's debut. And sure. I'm sort of surprised we didn't do this
right
back in the day.
I think it's also going to be a way we're going to make a lot of connections to things in. So when you go back to the debut of a beloved author, often it's a really interesting experience in like seeing the seeds, this author's core story we're going to talk about, and seeing the seeds that sort of get like tweaked, modified, perfected in later books. And I think both of us really read this book kind of like that's how I read it. It was like, you know, things I highlighted where I was like, oh, this is like, right? So
it is really interesting because as you're saying that, I'm thinking about like big authors and, you know, the most popular authors in the genre and the fact that their earliest books are most often not the books that people talk about, right?
Right.
I think about Lisa Kleypas. Her first two books, possibly three, are out of print. And you have to literally buy them on eBay. And
They're not even in E? Fascinating.
So you have to buy them on eBay. I have them. I bought them on eBay for a ridiculous amount of money, I would say. Sure. But only because, like, I think she's fabulous, and so I wanted to have them. I haven't read those either. I just have them. They're breaking case of emergency books. But I think it's telling that they're not in E.
Right.
Like, I think that probably speaks to an author who doesn't necessarily want those to be the books
easy.
That are out.
Right.
Right. I think about J.R. Ward and the fact that, like, she had a full career as Jessica Byrd writing Harlequins before she became J.R. Ward and started writing the series that we all know her for. Julia Quinn wrote a trilogy or possibly more before she started writing Bridgerton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that in 2021, we are conditioned to believe that if an author doesn't like go stratospheric with their debut, then they can't, you know, succeed. And it's really unfair.
Yeah.
Because
so much pressure.
Nobody's debut is perfect. You know, sometimes somebody comes out of the gate with a, like, just stunning debut.
Like Helen Wong. I mean, come on. The Kiss Quotient is a good example, right?
Come on.
Like,
for the most part, we, like, kind of lurch our way through a debut because we can't. There are lots of reasons, right?
Sure.
Like, there's a part of it is sometimes that you've been working on it for so long that, like, it's just either flabby or none of this is speaking to Cressley's book, but the point
in general,
is that, like,
right now, right.
I want to talk about debuts in general because I think readers, what's interesting is when I had my debut out, I think readers were a little more tolerant of flaws in a debut. They kind of understood, like, well, this is a new author, so like it might not be perfect, but like there might be a seed of something that we love in this. I think now readers, like I said, expect for the first book out of the gate to be just like a juggernaut, and that is a very hard thing to do. So like sometimes, so there, I think there are a few different ways that debuts can kind of go sideways. The first is, like I said, the author has been working on it for 10 years.
Well, and I think it's worth saying on the, okay, if we're talking about debuts through like a publishing house.
Oh, yes.
Right? That book is largely written and sold without, I mean, you're not really selling on spec the same way, right? Can you talk about that?
I can explain, yeah. Debuts are typically, not always, but often sold, I mean, like the majority of the time, they are sold complete.
Right.
So I sit at home in my kitchen and I write a 400-page novel and then I send it off to agents and editors and they read the complete novel and then decide if they want to publish it. So like the writing work is mine. Almost, right. It's exclusively mine. Like, the pacing is mine. I decide when I work. I decide when it's ready to go to be to publishing houses to be looked at. Again, this is traditional publishing. I mean, obviously, in independent publishing, you have to finish the book, too. But, like, right. It's a different kind of thing.
There's less gatekeeping to also, getting it in people's hands.
This particular book exists. Like, there was no independent publishing before this, like, right. In 2003. So this is how it would have been for Grassley. Right. She would have finished this book, probably, though, you know, maybe she was one of the tiny percentage who didn't have to. But I assume she finished the book. And then she would have sent it to an agent who sent it to Pocket Books at the time, to, you know, her editor there. And so Cressley Cole is born. But often because of that process, because you can kind of sit on it and noodle it and send it to a friend, and the friend gives you feedback, and your sister gives you feedback, and your mom gives you feedback, and, like, everybody gets to read it. Everybody gets it ends up being like a lot of cooks in this kitchen. And so sometimes, like, the book can be kind of all over the place, or the book can be a little flabby, or the book can be, like, the paced weird because it's just taking you so long. Like, there's no urgency to the writing, and therefore, like, you know, right. it reads long. Sometimes debuts can just be a little bit tweaky because the writers literally don't know the rules, right? They haven't learned, and I think I've talked about this before, but those early books, they're almost easier to write, I think, in my opinion. I think earlier books are easier to write. Certainly for me, they were, because I couldn't see the pitfalls coming.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So you're writing, you know, when you're writing, like, I don't know, whatever book, Nine Rules to Break When Romancing a Rake, which is my first romance, like, you're sort of writing along, and you don't know that if you make a decision in chapter 7, in chapter 22, you're going to have to reckon with it.
Right.
So
right.
You just write like a free bird until you get to 22, and then you're like, oh, no. And then, but what's cool about that is in the moment when you're like, oh, no, you're also like, I'm not going back.
Right.
Right? So I have to figure out how to make it work in chapter 22. So often, debuts become really interesting and, like, sure. Have really creative thinking behind them and, like, problem solving. And that's why often when we see a debut that we think is really fabulous, often it's because we've never seen an author tackle that particular problem or that particular speed bump in that particular way. And it's because they didn't know it was coming.
Right, right.
By book 14, you see it coming.
Right.
So in chapter 7, you're like, oh, shit. Right.
Well, and I would say as a from the reader critic perspective, it often, I feel like when I am reading a debut now, I try to be as, like, generous and open-hearted as I can, because debut authors are rookies, and rookies make rookie mistakes, right? Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that. As you said, it could be really interesting. But I also, there's a part of me that assumes also that most debut novels are like a real labor of love at some level.
It's the book of your heart.
Yes, exactly. This is the book that you wanted to write so bad you couldn't hold it in anymore. It had to be written. It had to come out. And so
I mean, to give you a sense of that, like, I wrote, so my first romance, Nine Rules to Break When Romancing a Rake, I wrote a YA romance before that, but I don't think of that YA romance as the book of my heart. That's like a different kind of thing, and I came to it in a different way. But Nine Rules was like that book for me. And the list that Callie, so the premise of Nine Rules, the heroine, it's true regency, like a real ballroom regency.
Yes.
And the heroine is like, she's, you know, on the shelf, she's overweight, she's plain looking, people don't, you know, she just is disappeared into society. And she decides, like, I'm going to live this life that I have always dreamed of living. I'm going to make a list of the 9 things I'm going to do to, like, really live, capital L. And they're like, ride a stride, attend a duel, kiss a man, like, whatever the things were. And that list is purely, like, reader Sarah's id. Right? Like,
right.
Just I'm going to write a book. It's going to tick every box I have. It's going to scratch every itch I have. The hero is a twin. Like, you know, everything about that book from like soup to nuts, right? There's a labyrinth. There's a, you know, there's lots of like heroine dressed in pants. There's, I mean,
all the things you love, right?
It's all things that now, 14 years later,
right,
are like, oh, of course there's a labyrinth.
Right.
There's a labyrinth in Bombshell 2, everyone. Spoiler alert.
Perfect. Okay, we haven't talked about Kressley's book yet at all. I don't care.
Wait. But I want to say something else about debuts, and I want to underscore it, which is the reason why debuts work, right? Like, why? Because all of the things that we've said are true, right? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I actually think that the thing that I said about, like, not knowing where the pitfalls are is actually really a benefit to new authors, young and new authors. But I think what's really interesting about the debut and how a debut author can really take hold of the world in some way is all voice.
Yes.
Right? It's almost as though when a reader picks up a book by a debut author and the slate is completely clean, mm-hmm. right? And it doesn't really matter if the book is flawed or like has issues or is paced weird, if the voice, the author voice, is strong and great.
Right.
Like, is the author really funny? Is the author really smart? Do I feel like the whole concept behind the book is clever and interesting? Like,
right. Is the chemistry really right? Right? All that stuff really?
Like, I think readers are instantly drawn to the idea of reading a book by a new author who is going to make them experience reading in a new way. Mm-hmm. And that is 100% authorial voice. And so that's why debuts are often so, one, why they sometimes capture us in such a powerful way, but also why we're so willing to kind of forgive them.
Sure, because it's giving us something else.
And we see this in romance, because I think in romance there are two kinds of debut, and maybe this is true of other genres too, probably is. There's the official debut, the like, this is the first book this author ever wrote. Mm-hmm. But then there's the first book by this author you ever read.
Yeah.
And that is your like reader debut. It's like mm-hmm. the debut of your heart.
Yes, so exactly. Speak. Right? Exactly.
And that is why what's fascinating to me as a writer is how often, I would say 75% of the time, when a reader comes up to me at a conference or at an event or like sends me an email, the book that made them love me is often the first book. Their favorite of my books is
the first one they read.
The one they read first.
Right.
And I can often tell if like a reader has been with me for 11 years or for a
year. Since Brazen or whatever, right.
By virtue of which book they love the most.
That's interesting. That makes sense to me.
But yeah. I was thinking about that a lot with this book because
right.
my, like, the Kressley book that I love the most is not Captain of All Pleasures.
No, because we just read it.
Yeah.
Before we move on to Kressley, I want to talk about a couple other things about debuts. As a reader, I really feel for a lot of authors right now who are debuting in trade paperback because they're expensive. And I do think that author, like the whole sort of like, you know, we're looking for an amazing voice and we're willing to follow that voice. I think I used to be a lot more forgiving of debuts when they didn't cost as much.
I think this is really tricky.
Yeah.
Partially, I see where you're coming from with cost being the
right.
issue. I don't know because I'm not privy to everybody's sales numbers all the time, although I wish I was. it feels to me like debut romance in general, that first book comes out and people buy it.
Yeah, we want to give it a chance. We're hungry for new authors, right?
I think that I see what you're saying, though, because I feel like in mass market, right, if you're paying $6 for a book.
Sure.
And you buy it and you love the voice, but like you feel like the story is kind of eh.
Right.
You'll pay $6 for the next one to
right.
see, right? But if you pay $14.99,
well,
you might not pay $14.99 for the next one.
Right.
And I see. Yeah. I mean, that's, of course, a worry, right?
Right. Now, again, I'm just like one reader, but I do think the way, and I think Kindle has changed it too, right? Because let's say this Kressley's, you know, look, so we're going to talk about Kressley for a minute here. Captain of All Pleasures comes out in 2003. It's going to be another year before I see another book by her on the shelves at Borders. And I'm going to be like, oh, yeah, I like that book. And I also think the pacing where, like, authors are, you know, a lot of authors feel they have to write so much faster now. I also feel like, you know, they're doing it because this is what fans want. I mean, the whole way the market of publication has changed. I don't have a, maybe I have a question. It's not a statement. I wonder how the pace at which books are released has changed the way we feel about debut authors and then their follow-up book. Does that make sense? And I don't have an answer.
You mean you wonder if the fact that authors are writing more quickly?
Well, some are and some aren't. Some are writing slower, but they're more expensive. Some are writing faster, but it's cheaper. It's like,
I also think things like, I mean, I think you can't discount things like Goodreads, right? Like,
absolutely. Or, like, or the fact that,
because here's the truth. Like, if you really, let's say you pick up a book in 2001, let's say you picked up a book by a random author. You read it and you were like, this is fine. This is a 6 out of 10.
Sure.
Right? Which for a romance reader is like, I would totally read another book by this person if it came absolutely across my desk, right? It's a 6 out of 10. The next year, when you see that name on the shelf, you don't have Goodreads to check, right?
Right.
Like, you maybe are keeping a reading journal, but are you really?
It's not with you in the store, right?
I mean, you'd be surprised. Some of those ladies really were on point. but the, you know, but you couldn't check and you'd see it and you'd be like, oh, I think I read, I read that.
I like that.
I'm going to buy it, right? Like, whereas you might have said, I mean, you might have said, oh, wait, like, I'm not going to get it this week. I just feel like there's,
that's what
my world is very different now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what I'm saying is maybe we don't know and it's different for different people.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's just different, right? My ability to check in with other readers or, you know, to kind of be like,
for readers to report in.
Yeah.
I mean, right. You weren't really able to do that either.
No. How you only had that if you were lucky enough to have friends who also read romance.
And there was Amazon, right? So, like, you could check your Amazon reviews, which at that point were better barometers.
Maybe. I don't even really remember relying on those.
If you were buying from Amazon, because you could also go to the bookstore, which is what, like, book readers, like, people who were reading 10, 12 books a month were still going to bookstores.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, I don't know how interesting all of this. We're sort of, like, down a rabbit hole on all of this. But I think that I just want to say, like, debuts are so important, and it's so important to support debut authors.
Yes.
Which I think you and I really do try to do on the podcast and IRL. but I just feel like, so that you all know, like, support your debuts, but also, like, when other authors, like, who've been around a long time, try new things or start a new, or, like, try a new genre, you know, support them too, because it feels like there's always, you never know when somebody's going to really hit it for you.
Right, right.
And I think this is why this is such an interesting experiment for me, because I really love the McCarrick Brothers series. I really love the Game Maker series. And we all know where I stand on IAD.
Right.
As far as Cressley goes. And this was really fascinating.
Yes.
To read just like something completely different that was, it's so obviously a first book. And so much in here that is so Cressley.
Absolutely.
But also you do feel like you're watching her like learn to drive a car.
Right. And that's what I would say with a debut is you're like, okay, this person's learning to drive the car. Am I interested in seeing them drive the next car? Yeah. And I think the one thing I want to talk about then is, again, this is if you are following kind of mainstream publishing track, like that second book then, I would expect to see a lot of growth because the second book is not written in a vacuum. right? The second book then
with an editor,
is written with an editor. And so I would say,
I mean, your first book will get edited. That's not.
But it's different.
But it's a different experience. Once you've had an editorial experience, the hope is that experience will inform the writing on the next round.
Right.
Also, I'm sorry, but there is something to be said for like the Malcolm Gladwell theory of like you have to write a million words.
Sure.
Before you know what you're doing.
Sure. Of course.
Which is from that book that we'll put it in the show notes. Sure, there's a famous book with an essay about how writers have to write a million words before they're actually like able to like compete.
right.
Whatever that means. But the point is, and I don't know if it's a million words or not, but whatever it is 14 books in, I think like I can do the job better.
Yeah. Well, and that's what, as readers, I want to see growth. Right? As a reader, I want to see growth. And sometimes that growth goes in a way that I'm like, okay, but not like that, because they change, you know, heat level or whatever. Sure, that's on them. And of course they get to do what they want.
That's not what I mean by
doing that. But that's not what I mean either, right? I mean like their characterization work, their plotting, their pacing, you know, their
fundamentally you're better at the writing of it.
Right. Absolutely. And that is a joy to see. And that's why I think so many of us, back to that, you read that first book, and then there's nothing better than discovering they have a huge backlist.
Yeah!
It is like it's like the romance readers.
This is a romance thing.
Oh,
right?
God, yes.
I mean, thrillers, I guess thrillers too, but
no.
Yeah, this feels really special to romance, this piece of it.
Yes.
And it's because we're the most voracious of readers.
Right.
Although I think kids, watching an 8-year-old, like, who loves to read.
Yes.
Like, back. You know, my daughter's eyes go wide when she realizes, like, she read Super Fudge with Eric. And then we were like, you know, Judy Blume. Hello. And she was like, what?
It's the best feeling. And so I think that's the other reason why we're constantly, you know, I do think romance readers love debut authors or love finding new authors because of that, right? Like the joy of then feeling like you literally like struck gold in the mine, and then there's the vein that you get to follow all the way down to the bottom.
Well, and also, and I know this from the Facebook group, the OSRBC Facebook group that I run, which is just, you know, 5,000 really excited, interested romance readers. I think romance readers also have a very remarkable way of being able to see that in writing. Yes. There's something romance readers, for all that we get shit on by the rest of the, you know, reading community, like we are so smart about the writing in general. You don't have to be a writer to understand in romance that, like, as you are reading an author's career out, their body of work, you're going to be able to perceive the changes in that work.
Right.
Right? I mean, and I think that in other genres, people just don't, they're not as loyal, probably, to an entire backlist.
Right.
And maybe they also just don't have such an extensive backlist to work with in many cases. Although I'm sure people who are voraciously reading Nicholas Sparks have probably noticed his evolution.
Well, I think mystery is similar, right? Because you get like long running series with the same character.
Like, I wonder if anybody out there was a Sue Grafton fan.
God, right.
My dad, I wish my dad was still alive. I would totally ask him about this. My dad was a huge Sue Grafton fan, and she had those like A is for
Alibi.
Alibi. I was like, assassin. I don't know what it was. Whatever.
Was for
it doesn't
alibi.
Matter. Nope. A was about Alibi all the way through. And, those had to have evolved, and like
when the characters in a long-running series evolve, people stick with it. When they don't, they like drop off. So an example, and it's fine, like she's making money hand over fist, so it doesn't matter, is the Stephanie Plum series by Janet Ivanovich. I loved at the beginning, but at some point I was like, Stephanie's not growing or changing enough for me. It's the same book every time. And then I didn't want to keep reading it. I just sort of had to like let it go. And so I think that, you know, that's part of that, you know, but then again, it's like, I'm sure that's like a real pitfall for her. If Stephanie grows too much or in a way some fans don't like, right? So I get that, you know, kind of creating a beloved character like that probably has its own pitfalls too. You see that sometimes in romance, right? Where someone's like, I just am now stuck writing about this family forever because people love
this
family.
Ongoing.
Right.
And we've all seen series like that where it should have ended four books ago.
Yeah.
Hard to do when the publisher, again, this goes back to traditional publishing more than anything else, but like the readers keep coming, the publishers keep coming, you know, they want more of the same. And I do think authors can get stuck in a rut. What is fascinating about Cressley, though, 35 minutes in, is like, talk about somebody who did not get stuck in a rut, right? Like, she did this pirate series, Victorian pirates. I swear to God, I picked up this book, Captain Ball Pleasures, pirate on the cover, pirates, ships. And I was like, it's going to be like set in the 1700s.
1854.
And it was like,
what? I was like,
fine. Cool. And then the McCarrick brothers, which is Scottish Highlanders.
Right.
And then IAD starts. Mm-hmm. And the McCarrick brothers and IAD happen. So IAD, Immortals After Dark, is paranormal.
Right.
The McCarrick brothers, the second two books in the McCarrick brothers and IAD are written simultaneously. So, like, it goes McCarrick 1, A Hunger Like No Other, McCarrick 2... whatever that next one was. And then McCarrick 3.
Rest for the Wicked.
Interesting. No Rest for the Wicked.
Well, and we talked about how the Game Maker series intersperses on the back end of IAD, but we never talked about the McCarrick brothers on the front end.
No. And then the Game Maker series gets, you know, pushed in.
And Arcana.
And she's writing YA at the same time. So, like, talk about somebody who is figuring out, like, how to keep her well full and not get stuck in a rut.
Right.
Which is why I think you get to the end of the Immortals After Dark series, and those are where, like, for me, and I know a lot of people don't agree with this, but I think the Moriora movement of IAD is really great. Like,
yes,
suddenly there's like a whole new, it feels like everything's reinvigorated again. And of course it is, because she's still working.
Right.
She's writing all over the place. That said, Captain of All Pleasures, tell everyone what they've won.
So it was really interesting, wasn't it? Okay, so it's Derek Sutherland is a drunken ship's captain. Nicole Lassiter is a young woman whose father is also she spent her entire life essentially growing up on ships with her father. And her mother died giving childbirth to, like, a younger, and her mother and the baby died. And so she's just with her father, even though her mother was part of the aristocracy in London. So, you know, her sort of taciturn, mean grandmother.
Yeah, we don't know it from the start.
Right.
But she's an heiress.
Well, we kind of know because...
We don't know she's going to inherit a title, do we? Spoiler, she's going to inherit a title.
We don't know that, but we do know that she has been in essentially like finishing school and grandmother paid for it. And she sort of busted out, right, to come and help her father win this race. And a shipping race? I don't even know. A sailing race? I'm like,
Victorian,
I don't even know.
The Victorian High.
Exactly.
For those of you who are, so unfortunately, for those of you who have not read Immortals After Dark, I think we're going to say some things that are probably going to leave you in the dark, but.
Let's try and make reference to it, though. So there's the sailing race. They're going to go from London to Sydney, but it's not like sort of a straight
shot. It's confusing.
Shot. Yeah. So they go to Brazil first. So they go to South America. And so it's like this great circle. And then they kind of drop down and go towards
and
Cape
follow
Town.
Follow along Antarctica to Cape Town.
Right. And then they're going to like shoot over to Sydney. And the thing that was really... So in book two of... So we're going to actually talk a lot about IAD because I think that's what was interesting to me, to like those seeds. In book two of IAD, there is a... kind of great, amazing race plot called the Talisman's High.
It's not just book two. It lasts multiple books.
That's true. That's true. Race. It does. Right.
It's basically the Amazing Race.
Right.
Four books.
Right.
And at least.
And it was really interesting because in this book, there's sort of a pretext for it. Like, if you win this race, it's going to help your shipping company's reputation. But basically, it's just a pretext to get Nicole and Derek Sutherland on this ship together, right? Because, you know, proximity, and we need these two together. She's determined to race for her father. He's going to race for himself.
But it's interesting because this is a good example of, like, it starts out, and there, so the he and her father are rivals.
Yep.
And there's like a whole beginning that feels a lot like, for those of you who have read, and I never recommend it for anything other than educational purposes, The Flame and the Flower. It starts a lot like The Flame and the Flower with like tavern, she's mistaken for a prostitute, like, yeah.
Here's my theory about, okay, we've talked about how the book of your heart romance, we can look back and see the seeds of what's going to grow, but I would also argue you can see a lot of the seeds of what they've read.
Well, that's what I was saying, right?
Right?
My first hero was a twin with blue eyes, and the twin brother had a scar on his face, and it was like...
But I also think, I thought a lot actually about Derek Craven, because it's Derek and his, and Lydia. And and I found myself thinking about, like, sort of the drunkard and the, you know what I mean? Like, some of those clay pot heroes of the 90s.
Well, yeah, because he gives up drinking, and I wondered if, I wanted to check and see if, again, the magic was before or after this. I think it was before this.
I felt a very clay pot hero-y in some ways, right?
Well, you know how I've talked a lot over the, I don't know how much we've talked about it on the podcast, but you and I have talked about the fact that, like, I really, someday when I, like, have no time, when I have time, I want to really, like, draw out the way I think of the family tree of romance, like, with these, like, you know, the way that the kind of huge movements in romance and the, like, really big, like, grandmothers and of romance have sort of created this massive tree. And there is, in my head, a Clapas branch that comes off as very close, but very, you know, its own branch, but very similar to that, like, McNaught branch, right? Like, they're on the same branch.
Right.
And, I mean, it's clear Cressley is there. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Coming right off of...
Coming right off Lisa. Of... Yeah, well, and not only that, but the gentle rogue, the pirate, right? Sort of the pirate.
Yeah.
The pirate movement, right?
Well, and when we were talking about IAD, when we talked about... God, I'm sorry. In season one, I never knew the titles. I still don't know the titles. Demon, Kiss of a Demon King. That we talked about Kiss of a Demon King basically being fanfic for Prisoner of My Desire.
Right. That's right.
Which was a Joanna Lindsay, like, very old school. Again, check your content warnings. I felt that way too. I mean, this is clearly, it's gentle roguey. Like, it harkens back to all those big old pirate books. What's fascinating, though, is on the reread, or
the first read.
The first read, on the first read in 2021 is how pirate books don't really exist anymore.
Because they're problematic as fuck.
Well, aside from them being, I mean, yes. Okay. So,
well, let's talk about why.
let's talk about this, because don't tweet at us. I know some people still write pirates, but, like, there was a time in the 90s. The 80s and 90s, when, like, everybody was writing a pirate.
Yes.
Everybody put a romance on a ship.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, there was always he was always a secret duke or a secret earl.
Listen to me. If there was Twitter back in 1990 fucking two, it wouldn't have been there's only one bed. It would have been there's only one bunk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? It was all pirates. Nobody was ever in winter.
Yeah.
They were on the ocean.
She knocked her head in a storm. And he had to be lashed to the wheel. I mean, like, all of this. This is all
that,
like,
stuff. Yeah.
Cressley could easily have just sat down, written out, like, promise of the premise of the pirate book. It's all in here. It's packed in here. Anyway, so I know some people still write pirate books. This is not any shade to them. They're just not as common anymore.
Well,
and go.
Well, because you can't do it without
they're
talking
problematic.
About...
problematic.
You can't do it without talking about slavery and colonialism. I mean, you can't.
Well, you certainly can't do it without talking about... But here's the thing. This is why the race is essential.
Yes.
Because Cressley, largely, and I say largely because there is a situation in Brazil that we're going to have to talk about... Cressley largely elides the slavery issue, and she has to.
Of course. Right?
I mean, at this point, the slave trade, she picked a time period where, like, the Caribbean slave trade is drying up, if not dried up.
Right.
Right? But so there's a time period thing, and I think that's really interesting because part of the reason why it's so surprising that it's the 1850s and right. 60s is because it shouldn't be. Like, pirate lore,
right?
You know, romance pirates aren't from the 1800s. They're from the 1700s.
I mean, this is essentially 5 years before the Civil War.
No, but Cressley's right? not yeah, stupid. She's like, brilliant. And she's like, I want to write a pirate romance, but I don't want to have to do any of that. Like, I don't want it to be gross.
Right.
And so instead of them shipping through the Caribbean or having to deal with the Caribbean or slave ships or any of the things that pirates were a part of in the 1700s, which romance was eliding just by virtue of, we're not going to talk about it. Cressley was like, I'm going to elide it all by putting it in a different time period.
Right.
Which I think is a really interesting choice, right? Like, it's a choice that is progressive for 2003.
Sure.
And, you know, is not enough for 2020.
Well, and they're not really pirates, right? Like, these are legal shipping businesses that they want to
they kind of are pirates because at some point he like takes her ship, presses he impresses her entire crew into service,
right?
Like, which is a piratey thing to do. So like, I like a pirate romance, but like, I think what's happening here is we're almost, and we talked about this with A Hunger Like No Other, which is about to be published just like 2 years later.
Right.
Cressley is a brilliant, brilliant romance writer writing books at a time when the entire genre is shifting.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so she is basically embodying this movement of the genre from pre-2000 to post-2000. Mm-hmm. And that is not an easy task because you can see the push-pull of it. Like, mm-hmm. I want to write a pirate romance, but I don't want to deal with any of the shit that pirates have to, that pirate romances come with. I don't want any of that baggage. So instead of them being, like, true pirates, they're, you know, shipping magnates who also who race boats and also will press your gang into service and drop them off to be like hanged for insurrection or whatever in Cape Town.
Right.
So I think this is really interesting because you see her on the page spinning the wheel.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
How do I get out of all of these things?
That's what I would say makes this or marks this really as a debut for me. Okay, like, you know how if you turn a garment inside out and you can see the seams?
Yeah.
It feels like sometimes in a debut, you can see the seams, right? They're there. And I think a lot of it was around the plotting of, like, how do I get these two on the boat together? Right? A lot of that, it just, does that make sense?
It feels really old school. It feels like a McNaught novel in the sense that, like, there's a lead up to these two. So the money of this book is the two of them racing, and they're on separate. So Cressley gives herself several huge problems here.
Right.
First problem is, how do you get these two alone? She clearly wants to write a pirate book. She wants to write a book on the open sea.
Yep.
How do you get these two onto the open sea is the first question. And it takes a long time.
Remember when we talked about Gentle Rogue and we were like, it started in the wrong place?
Yeah. I'm not sure this one does start in the wrong place, but like, it takes a long time to get them onto the open sea.
It's not as tight as it needs to be, right?
No, and then when they're when they're on the open sea, they're on separate ships.
Yeah, I know. And then I was like, how are you going to solve this one?
Like, and they can't just walk, they can't, like, run into each other, except they do. And
in
that's
Brazil.
Amazing. Wait, do they run it? Is that the first time when they're in Brazil? When's the shipwreck?
Brazil is first, then the shipwreck. So the other part of the plot you need to know is that there's a villain, and the villain, her father, is like, I hate Sutherland, but I know it's not him, because as much as I hate him, he's a stand-up guy. But someone is trying to essentially attack or sabotage the boat's ships, whatever, that will be in the race so that they can win. And he's trying to figure out who. So there are several stops. So the thing about, I guess, these, you know, journeys is there's a lot of fossils. There's a lot of boat talk here.
This is the problem with putting a romance on a boat, everyone. I mean, there's, like, I joke a lot that, like, you can't put a romance on a boat because you end up having, like,
too much, like, boat shit, right?
It's just no one cares.
Like, being on a boat is a lot of work and kind of boring. And also, right?
Yeah. You know? Like, there's nowhere to go. You can't, like, you're sort of stuck on this boat. The only thing that can really be exciting and happen are storms and pirates.
Sure. And those things happen. But so they go from London to the coast of Brazil. This is sort of the first stop on this journey. And they're going to get out and reprovision for then, like, the journey to Cape Town. And when he's there, he goes to his favorite brothel, as one does.
Wait, but he goes there to look for her, doesn't he?
No, I don't think so.
I thought he heard she was there.
No, the madam is actually a friend of hers. Remember?
The madam is like her like, and, surrogate mom.
Yeah. And so, you know, Nicole has been like, oh, there's this guy I like, and we're on the race together. And so when he shows up,
there's this guy I like. For the record, Nicole never says that. But of course.
She does.
There's
though.
This guy I hate.
Yeah, right. But
I can't stop thinking of how much I hate him and his thighs.
Her surrogate mom is like, I think you like him. And I happen to know who this guy is. And luckily for me, he's one of my good customers. So when he shows up, she's like, kind of like, oh, I think, are you looking for a redhead? Right? Remember? And then he, like, goes with another woman, but he's only with her for, like, 5 minutes because, he cannot be with anybody else but Nicole. And
real romance novel shit here.
Like, oh, for sure. Like, once you have your real true love in your sight.
He's so old school, too.
Oh, God,
like, I want to keep going with this, but, like, this is a good point for us to just underscore. He's, like, what's his name? The first vampire book in Lachlan.
Absolutely.
Often when we tell everybody, like, okay, you're going to start IAD, you have to start with A Hunger Like No Other and just get through the first 120 pages.
Sure.
Until someone gets punched in the face.
And then you're fine. Right.
And then you're fine. And what we propose in the first episode of Fated Mates, when we read A Hunger Like No Other, was that what Cressley was doing was literally setting the ancient old school hero on the page to break him completely and restructure him as a modern
hero,
like post 2000 romance hero.
Yep.
And this guy is, Derek is old school.
Oh, for
like,
sure.
There's a moment where he thinks to himself, if I weren't so angry, like, I had intended to, like, make love to her, but I'm furious, and so now it's just going to be a quick fucking. Yeah. And I was like, what? And that's not, none of that happens. Like, but it's just,
sure.
He has thoughts that are primitive.
Oh,
they're
primitive. Yes, that's like, a great way of putting it, yeah.
And so you're just like, you need to fucking evolve. And what's amazing is Nicole basically says to him, like, no, we're not.
Yeah, like, I'm not into it. And actually, it's interesting because
Flame in the Flower by the
book. So the madam then sends him out like a door she's never sent him out before. And then he hears, you know, someone giggling and it's like, it's Nicole. I just recognize her or whatever. And this is some real wild shit too. One of the women at the brothel is putting a henna tattoo on her, but like on her.
It's her. It's Maria.
Oh, he goes out this other door that Maria's, the madam, has sent him down, and he hears this, you know, he hears Nicole's voice, like, laughing or something, and he, like, knows immediately that it's her, of course, and he kind of spies on what's going on, and one of the women who, it's kind of unclear, I don't know if it's someone who works in the brothel, but she's Indian, is giving Nicole, like, a henna tattoo, but it's on her, like, abdomen and under her breasts. It's, like, super sexy, and he is, of course, like, this is super sexy. What are you doing here, right? And they run into each other, and it's clear then, like, we now understand, oh, like, Nicole knows the woman who owns the, you know, the madam is, like, Nicole's surrogate mother and has sort of set up this meeting. She actually, like, locks the door on them, right? Like, she's like, you two have to talk to each other. Like, just Can I make that happen?
So I do want to pause here and say Sasha, the heroine, the woman who is applying the henna.
Yeah.
She is Indian and she is working at this brothel in Brazil.
Yeah.
So there is like a nod here to colonialism, but the henna piece is kind of weird.
Yes.
And confirmed to me from Nisha Sharma, who knows a lot about henna, that like the idea that henna would be able to like give you good luck or like summon some kind of like luck or person to you or like provide some kind of protection, like all of that stuff is really like ancient view. So like, okay, again, 1860, probably not happening quite this way. So I just want to put it, I just want to note that like there's something in this book that, again, the time period, Cressley is really, she's doing a lot of extra work here as a writer, trying to figure out how to tell this story without, while being respectful, but also clearly wanting to, like, acknowledge that there's some kind of, like, colonial shit going on here.
Right, right.
But she never quite, like, digs into it. Again, this is one of those situations where, like, I feel like Cressley knows that she knows that there's something to be said here, but she's not sure what it is to be said.
Right.
And so she's, like, nodding at it and moving forward, which is time period, I guess. And
sure. And 20 years later, it's also hard to parse as well, right?
I will say this. The scene is odd. It's like a...
Yes.
It pulled me, I don't know if it pulled you out of the book, but it pulled me out of the book. I was like, what's henna happening? What's happening here?
Right.
It feels odd because in 2021, it's hard to tell whether Cressley was nodding at colonialism and saying a thing or right. I'm not sure.
Right. Exactly. And I think that's back to a lot of things. One is, I also, and you and I both know this, that like romance novels are really, I think, highly attuned to pop culture. So sometimes when I read a romance novel now as it's happening, I can see how it is talking or in concert or in conversation with other things that are movies, TV shows, whatever. So it feels a little bit like reading that scene with the henna now in 2021, what I found myself wondering is Cressley as a white author trying to like, okay, colonialism was happening and I can't pretend it isn't? Or was there something else happening in pop culture that made her know that her readership would understand henna tattoos or, right? Mm. I mean, and like, does that make sense? And so I, like you, really stopped at that moment and just thought, this is interesting to me. And I don't know how to parse it. It was interesting. Yeah,
especially because at the time in 2003, white historical writers were not regularly including women of color in books.
Right.
As primary or secondary or tertiary characters, right? So I think there's something interesting happening there. And this brothel is represented really positively. Like, these are sex workers who are doing work, who are and are respected in their work.
Yep.
And I think that's really important too here. This is sex work laid down on the page in a historical without shame. And that's about, like, Cressley's doing something here. Yeah. It's just hard to tell.
Sure.
Because we're not in 2003.
Right. And I think that's it. I think sometimes, I mean, that's the hard part, right? Like, it just really, and so there are several times in the book where I found myself thinking, like, this is interesting, but I don't know quite what to make of it.
Well, it's also suggested, and perhaps this is reconciled in the second book in the series, but it's suggested that her father and the madam of this brothel is, they are ultimately going to be in love.
Right.
They're going to be partnered.
Right. And it's, there's never a hint at all that she would not be an appropriate partner for her father because of her past as a sex worker.
Which is amazing.
in some ways, Nicole's journey, right, which is my grandmother wants me to be a lady and be part of the aristocracy, but I love the sea, right? And I have grown up on ships my entire life. And I, you know, that tension does feel in some ways like a Cressley heroine, mm-hmm. right? There's a lot of older women in the book, right? Both the madam and her mm-hmm. grandmother. And I kind of found myself thinking of like the Valkyries, right? Like this whole like mm-hmm. sort of other generation and like the, you know, kind of like who are you going to end up being? But in some ways too, I found Nicole's behavior like a little inexplicable, only in the sense that it was like so non-historical. Like what I read in historicals.
No, it's, I mean, but that's where you start to see real Cressley come out.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Like, this heroine is a Cressley Cole heroine. She says modern things. She does modern things. She is kind of a badass. She captains her own ship. She does a lot of things. She doesn't take shit from anyone. Mm-hmm. She doesn't take no for an answer. Like, she is right. kind of a Valkyrie, an right. early stage Valkyrie.
Like a proto Valkyrie, right?
Yeah. And I think, so what she's done is she's really written Valkyrie, Sebastian, like a Roth brother Valkyrie combo here.
Yeah. Very much.
Where it's like just a super duper alpha and like this kind of take no prisoners heroine. And the challenge with this book is that they're not together.
Right. Right.
Enough. Right.
And I would say the other challenge. So, okay. So then what happens is they leave Brazil and both of their boats are in trouble.
They've both been sabotaged, we right. know, but...
Yeah, the drinking water on his boat has been sabotaged, so his whole crew is essentially sick. And then the actual physical mechanisms of the boat, whatever, the rudder and something else have been...
Boat's broken.
Romance reasons. Boat reasons. Boat's broken. And so he ends up saving her and her crew.
There's a terrible storm.
Right.
She lashes herself to the wheel, which is a real, like, piratey ship romance thing to do, but usually done by the hero.
Right.
And not the heroine. Instead, she does it to herself.
Then there's, you know, a solid 100 pages after that of essentially them not understanding each other, right? He is convinced that she poisoned the water for whatever reason. You know, she is just like, fuck this guy because he's taken my whole crew and then is going to have them, you know, turned in for mutiny and killed.
Right.
So, and I found that this kind of the misunderstanding, And then even when they told each other the truth, they sort of default back to misunderstanding, probably was the part where I was like, this isn't quite working the same way later Cressley does.
There are a lot of secrets in this book.
Yeah.
Later Cressley, and this is a real, I mean, I remember this feeling from when I was a young, early writer. Like this sense that, so I think one of the biggest mistakes the new writers make, and I've made it many times myself, is feeling as though if you give up the secret too early, there won't be enough book. And so what ends up happening is you keep the secrets from the characters and from the reader for too long.
Yep.
And so it starts to feel like, what are we even doing here?
Right.
Whereas if you give up the secret when it feels like it's the right time to give up the secret, often what you have to trust yourself as a writer. And that is a hard thing to do in the early days. Like, you have to trust that if you reveal the secret early, there will be more secrets and plot to come. Like that it will. And often for those of you who are out there writing and you're struggling with this, let me tell you that I have never given up a secret on a book and not had it made things worse and not better. Right? Like, so worse for the characters. Like, we're like more complicated for the plot rather than easier. Right. And so I think that, but she's pulling the punch here.
Yes.
And I don't think she's doing it on purpose. I think she's doing it because she doesn't know she's doing it.
Right? Yeah. Rookie mistakes, right? So I think that
So you're right, because that piece, I'm sorry, but that segment of the book, for those of you who have read the book this week, it goes from they're on that boat and it's really romantic. I mean, talk about, there are some really romantic moments that are true Cressley moments. Like, this whole time, they're not talking. They're not speaking during the day, but at night, she is cold. She's always cold, this heroine. And the first thing he ever does for her, when he thinks she's still a sex worker, she's cold, and he gives her his socks, a clean pair of socks, and warms her feet. And it's like, it's St. Vincent.
Yep.
But, and the warming block for Evie. But the, so there's, you know, he's always keeping her warm. And so she shivers at night in the bunk in his cabin, and they're not looking at each other even during the day. But every night he walks into his cabin, he takes off his clothes and he climbs into bed with her, and he just holds her and is like her furnace for the night. And they never discuss it. It happens. They don't have sex. They don't touch other than for him to like wrap himself around her and keep her warm. And it is so Cressley.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, if you love that, you're going to love IAD.
And then at one point, he's like, why aren't you wearing the clothes that I put out for you? Right?
Yeah. And she's like, that's why you're putting clothes out for me? And he's like, I want you to wear my clothes. I want you to be warm.
I want you to wear my clothes. I mean, hello.
It's so romantic.
Right?
And so this whole time, they're not talking. And they're not talking to the reader either. Also, we're in his point of view and not hers most of the time, which I think is important, but like she's a cipher during that whole period.
Right.
And then the secrets start coming out and they come out bang, 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 bang. And you're like, what's happening? Like,
whoa, what's happening? And it's hard at that point to know whether, I mean, it feels like it's very hard, I think, to introduce that much plot into, like, the last third of a book successfully. Because it feels like, as a reader, and I'm not saying this is true, but as a reader, sometimes it just feels like, well, you got yourself into a plot hole and couldn't figure out how to fix it, so you threw some dirt on the, you know what I mean? You built up something.
It's interesting, right? Because she does hold a lot back from the reader. Like, we don't know Nicole is about to become a marchioness.
Right.
Right? So it's sort of explained away in the text as like, because of some deal politically, however many hundreds of years ago, this particular marquisate can pass to the eldest female child if there is a woman right in the family and no men, a girl and no boys.
Right.
And so she is set to become a marchioness, which is like, bigger than an earl. He's an earl. She'd be higher ranked than he is. And so, like, that's sort of a surprise.
Sure.
It's a surprise that she's super, like, that is the big surprise, because that means she on her own is destined to be super rich.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
She doesn't need his money. And I mean, he's married. He's married. Right. Right.
And it's interesting because Cressley doesn't give us, it comes out of left field, that marriage.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, she gives us, it's not possible for us to marry, like, way early in the book. And I mean, so says every romance hero.
Exactly. I'm not going to ever marry her.
Okay, right. Dummy.
Right. So, yeah, all that stuff feels really interesting in the sense that it felt, like I said, it just felt like the seams were showing.
Seams are showing, but the truth is that the cut is still Cressley. Like,
yeah,
it's all, I mean, those secret, that structure is Cressley Cole, right?
Absolutely.
Where, like, everything, I mean, how many hundreds of times did I say that first season? Like, I can never see how she's going to thread the needle. Like,
yeah.
She lays it all out. By the time she hits Immortals After Dark, right, she's laying out the threads for the whole story, not just the book, but also, like, the small movement of the series, plus the 18-book arc, right? Like, she's laying out all these threads in such powerful ways. And you as the reader see the threads. And I mean, like, I as a reader could never stitch them together the way she was going to.
Right.
And I think that in this book, she lays out the threads and I'm just like watching her stitch them together like she's an apprentice and not.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
And not like, you know, sure. a designer.
Right. And that's okay. Like that's the it's a debut part. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I hope we're not, it doesn't sound like we hated this book because I didn't, I mean, like, I'm fascinated.
It was a fascinating thing to read as a Cressley fan.
As a right? first book. Yeah.
What I do want to talk about, which I think was real interesting, was sex.
Because sex scene, finally, first of all, oh my God, it was the slowest burn.
Yeah. Well, that I was like, what the fuck, Cressley?
Cressley, we expected more. But you could see it, too. That was her pulling the punch, too. So have I ever told the story about... I must have told this story. I'm going to tell it again.
Okay.
So I wrote my first book, which was YA, and then I got myself an agent. I don't recommend doing it in that order. I don't recommend doing it in that order ever, but that is what I did. I wrote my first book, I sold it, and then I got an agent. And then I wrote 9 Rules to Break When Romancing Rake. And my agent, who was a YA agent at the time, took it out to romance. She read it, and then she took me to lunch in New York City, and we're in this like packed New York City diner, and she's sitting across from me, and this was, and my agent at the time was a woman named Alyssa Eisner-Henkin, who is fabulous, and the only reason why I'm not still with Alyssa is because she only did YA, and I don't do YA anymore, but she was great, highly recommend, and she was so eager and, like, excited about this new project, and she was like, so... I can see her face. So, we are packed. It is lunch hour in Midtown. Like, we are packed in to a diner. There is somebody. I do not have to extend my arm to touch the businessman next to me. And she says to me, so, I've been asking around, and apparently there are no rules as far as what you can put into the book except no anal. And she said it so loudly,
yes,
and so matter-of-factly, and literally, it was like next to us on both sides. It just went silent, and in that like New York City kind of silence,
where
like, they were not going to look, but like, what the hell were these two ladies talking about?
It's amazing. Oh my God.
So anyway, again, like 2000. So that was 2009.
Now
so this is 2003, and you can see Cressley like she wants to. Make these two do it real bad.
Yeah. And she doesn't. And it's fascinating. I will say, okay.
Like, it's so close. Like, it's so hot. And then she pulls it back. Like, it's excruciating.
I've got to tell you, I was like, I'm not sure I have ever actually read them getting interrupted. It's her first goddamn time.
He's and inside he's in her.
He is in her. And it's like a knock on the door. And I was like, what is happening
well,
right
also,
now?
Well, also, there's a hymen situation here. We've talked about this before. The hymen's way up in there. That's not where the hymen is, everyone. Also, we're going to link to a very important TikTok by Dr. Jennifer Gunther, author of The Vagina Bible, who talks about the hymen and what it really is there for and why this hymen conversation is nonsense. But anyway. But the hymen is not like a steel barrier up in there.
You gotta burst through like a
like a Kool-Aid
battering
man.
Ram. Like a Kool-Aid man. Oh my God. So they have now, but I would also say like the pacing this moment is fascinating because here you have these two in bed, they're gonna have sex for the first time. He finally is like, we're gonna do it. She's like, let's do it. They're interrupted by essentially a terrible storm. That, you know, essentially like, and I'm kind of like, do they blow in this fast? I have no idea. Whatever. But the thing that's fascinating.
That's what she said.
Yeah, of course. I give you that. It's a gift. The thing that's fascinating, though, about the pacing in that moment is we get none of it. We essentially, it opens the next chapter is them.
The storm is over, right?
The storm is over, and they are like creeping into Sydney Harbor. And everyone's exhausted because they like fought, you know, the whole night to whatever, keep the boat alive or whatever people do on the boat. And I was just like, it was so weird to me. And then when they finally do have sex, I was was like,
so good though.
I was seriously like, goddamn, imagine you're like,
she knocks that fucker out with a bottle of rum or some shit.
Yes.
He's out cold. She ties him to the bed.
Ties him to the bed.
And when he wakes up, she's like, peace out. I'm leaving. And then she's like, hang on.
She's like, I'm taking your money and I'm leaving. And then she's like, wait, maybe we should fool around a little first.
But she doesn't untie him.
No.
It's so Cressley, though. Like,
yes.
And it started, and I was like, oh, shit. Like, Cressley's taking the gloves off because she has been holding herself back together for 350 pages. And now here we go. Cressley Cole's on the scene.
Yes.
And she delivers. That scene is hot.
I was like, God damn. That scene
is tie me to the mast hot.
Yeah, it was. I was like, whoo. I was like, the thing that was amazing is I was like, it's so primal, right? I was like, whoever installed your buttons installed Cressley's buttons too. That's how I felt, right? Because you hadn't read this before you wrote Raisin. But then the part two is, like, she then falls asleep on top of him.
With and him, this is my favorite thing from, can I say?
Oh, yeah.
My favorite thing from old school historicals, Virginia Henley used to do this all the time, was everyone falls asleep while they're still he's still inside her, which is nonsensical, I know.
Sure.
But, like, again, I was 12 or 13 when this button was installed, and I love it. Even though I've never written it because it's nonsense.
Sure. And he stays inside her so long that he basically gets hard again. And they do it again. And then she's like, peace out. Now I've really had my way with you twice. So I'm going to go.
And then he leaves her. What an asshole.
Well, her first mate arrives in Sydney. And, you know, but there's actually, you know what else? So there's a long interlude of them just being lovers in Sydney.
Yeah, right? Yeah, but it's like a paragraph.
I think it's more than that. But
it feels like a paragraph. I wanted it to be more.
It feels like a paragraph, but time passes. A lot of time passes in this book, but I was also really fascinated by that because I think it's a way in which it really shows that Nicole, that although her grandmother wants her to live that aristocratic life, there's no part of that in Nicole's psyche even. She never once thinks, I'm doing something that's wrong or forbidden. She is just like, I love him and I love being with him and this blazing affair where we like don't leave the cabin for days because we are fucking like crazy, right? And she like, everyone on the boat loves her because she always helps and she's part of the crew. But I was fascinated by this. And then there's this scene where they walk by a jewelry store. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I'm going to buy her these beautiful sapphires. And she's like, yeah, those are nice, but look, fresh strawberries.
You forgot the part where that scene happens immediately after he's like, I'm going to make you my mistress.
Yeah.
And she's like, oh, no, that's not going to happen.
Right.
And then he's like, well, I'll never. He's such a dick.
He's such like, a jerk. Yeah.
He's like, I'll never make you my wife. That's not possible. Right. And you're like, and it isn't possible because he's married, but like none of us know that.
Right.
And it feels like the tone that he uses is like,
so shitty, right?
Sort of shitty, man. Like,
yeah.
And she's pretty great.
And she's like, well, fuck you. I don't want to live on land anyway.
And in her mind, she's like, I'm going to be a rich heiress marchioness. Like, why do I need you?
Yeah, it is. And that's the part that I also really liked about Nicole was I think a lot of historicals, especially older ones, mm-hmm. We understand the like breaking the patriarchy kind of role that they play, but we don't talk as much as we should maybe about how we see young women trapped by their roles as well. And the books I like best now are ones like yours where they're like, I'm breaking out of this. This isn't for me.
Yeah.
She has no preoccupation whatsoever with those artificial rules of society. No. All of that is a game to her.
Yes.
She's going to gamify it all. These are like I need to know how to use this fork to know how to use this fork, but no part of me thinks knowing how to use the fork or not is important.
Right.
Right?
Well, I mean, I really think that there's something else here. Like, I think there are so many pieces of it that are so crustly. I think that by the time we get to the end, there's, you know, there's still that sort of, I love the scene where he's like, he turns up at her house at 7 a.m. Yeah. and is like, I'm taking you to Gretna Green. And she's like, no, you're not. And then he walks into the house and like talks to her very cool grandma, like,
well, grandma,
Lord of Scoundrels style grandma.
Well, she was terrible at the beginning, but once she was like, oh shit, Nicole almost died, she's like, I better stop being such a jerk, which is a real sudden turnaround, but I was fine with it.
I mean, I was really fine with it because I love when he's like, I'm taking her to Gretna Green, and she's like, well, okay.
Sounds good. Get back to me when you're back. All
Whatever
I wanted
needs
was
to happen.
To, and I just wanted like, her to wear, marry a nice man, and you are an earl, so sounds
Let
fine.
Me break it down, Grandma. I'm the fifth earl of Stanhope. And I want to marry your girl. And she's like, all right, fine. I love it. And then he is basically like, and then he professes his love in that way that a Cressley hero does, where it's like, he's basically just like, I can't live without you.
Right.
I cannot live without you.
Right.
Mine. And that is it, like, that's just it.
And so therefore I'm going to get over my shit. I'm going to stop drinking.
Yeah. I quit drinking on the way back. I mean, there's a lot of like kind of everything's handled. But you know what? I kind of like that. Here's the thing about historicals. Like sometimes you just want the historical where it's all just sorted out in the end.
Yeah.
Everything's going to be fine.
Right.
Here's how everything's going to be fine. And then you get to read about my brother in the next one.
I think there was one part that I thought was very like crustly because I think Nicole is a more interesting character than Derek. Derek is a very, like, kind of...
He's central casting.
Yes, the central casting alpha. But there's one part in particular that I really thought to myself, now this is Cressley, where I think he's... I can't remember who he's talking to, but, you know, he's sort of like, And they say, you know what? You need to be hopeful about your future. If you're not going to be hopeful about your future, then you're going to live in misery. And I found myself thinking that that little speech could have been about Rune. It could have been about Cian. It could have been about any of those Roth brothers, right? Mm-hmm. That like a Cressley hero is essentially like frozen in misery, whatever, right? Whatever that state of being is, until they see a potential different future. And that is what makes a Cressley, like, motivates a Cressley hero to change. And, you know, of course, it's almost always this, like, younger woman. But that, I thought, was a really interesting distillation of what makes a, like, right in that moment, I thought, that is the Cressley core story for a hero, right? Something about my life does not please me, and I can't fix it. I'm just stuck with it. It seems like I will be stuck with it forever. But then all of a sudden...
Yeah, well, the heroine... the core story of the Cressley heroine is, like, bang shit against this wall until it breaks.
Yeah.
And that's that.
Right.
Like, until it breaks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so in that sense, I did feel like they... Like, you know, the plotting and pacing
and
stuff
the hero,
aside.
Yeah. Including the hero. Yeah.
Right. The best scene in this book to me, because I fucking love it when they suffer, is he has to leave her. He has to leave her, you know, for romance reasons, alone in Sydney.
Because it's the last quarter of the book. He has to go away.
Right.
80% of the way through, he has to leave.
Yeah. And he is on the boat with the sapphires he bought her, but he never had a chance to give to her. And he, this motherfucker, throws them overboard in a fit.
Oh, and I was like,
and I was like, that is, you know, Maxim sleeping in his bathtub. That is Lothair cutting out his
Cian leaving right? all hell. Like,
yes, right. I was like throwing the sapphires overboard. Yeah, cut out my heart. All that's all that is. And it was like, and I like it.
Yes,
and I like it.
I'm for it. Suffer. He deserves to suffer at that moment. Like, well, come on. I mean, he hasn't told her anything. She doesn't understand. Right. He could have said, "I'm married," but instead he said, "I want to make you my mistress, and I'm leaving." Like,
well, and I would say that that's one thing that. In this book, I would not expect to see in future Cressley books, which is the ways in which the men in Nicole's life keep secrets from her, right? And she, like, so it's like her first mate essentially kind of talks him into leaving. And then she can tell that something's up and he kind of feels guilty, remember?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because in a, the first mate figures it out, right? We're in the first, basically, we and the first mate figure out that Derek is married at the same time.
Yes.
And Nicole is not on the page.
Right.
And in future Cressley books, Nicole would have figured
that's
it
right.
out with
that's
us.
Right. And that's part of it. Like, she's
that's, again, that's a date. That's a rookie mistake.
Yep. She's the bang it against the wall heroine, but she is not yet the I'm smarter than everybody else here heroine.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that felt a little different to me, like the proto.
Yeah.
The proto heroine, maybe.
I mean, it's a very cool experience to read the first book by basically your favorite author.
Yeah.
I think Jen and I pretty much are on the docket as the biggest Cressley Cole fans out there. And it is wild to read her first book.
It really is.
With how well we know.
Yes.
Like her, you know, her most recent series, her Imperial series.
Yeah, right. It's like, yeah, it's a really cool experience, I think.
There were definitely moments where I was like, oh, he's going to get the heads of her enemies. Like, she finds there are enemies. There are, like, two kind of low-level, like, gross villains who they stumble upon in Sydney. And she's like, they're the ones who hurt me. And he just, like,
levitates off the page. Yeah,
God.
Exactly.
I'm going to go destroy them. I mean, it's great.
It is.
It's great. Look, if you're looking for a fun, like, high seas adventure with kissing and also tie me to the bed sex, we have a book for you.
We do.
And if you even a little bit enjoyed this, go back to season one and read A Hunger Like No Other. Do not read the first book on Goodreads, everyone. We have to say it again. It's called A Warlord Wants Forever. Don't read that first. We have a special reading order. Read it when we get to it in season one.
If you look at, I just updated actually that page because I had Kelly make some, we did there twice, two times there, we did like a double episode and I had Kelly like remake the icon so you see both books at once in like one box in the right order.
You're amazing.
You know, Kelly is.
Kelly's really tolerant of your drama. Kelly, everyone, I'm going to tell everybody your problem.
Fine.
Jen has a problem, which is that she can't deal with it when in show notes, the grid of book covers is uneven. So if one row has five books, all the other rows have to have five books, or we have to figure out how to add or subtract books to make every row have four books. Like, it's kind of a nightmare on Tuesdays, I gotta say. And so,
I just handle it, though. I handle it. You don't even really
I know, but
know.
When I'm like, I'm adding such and such.
I know, I'm all
she
like...
She always, 3 years, you guys, and she still
be
doesn't
like,
trust me to know.
Because
she
like,
always
even?
Reminds me to make it even. So today, this morning, I got a text from Kelly that was like, Sarah, I was fixing this thing, and then we had an uneven row, and so... She asked for my permission to put something else in, and that was fine. But really, Jen.
Sorry. You guys, everyone right now, you can go ahead and tweet me and be like, it looks nice when all the rows are even.
It does. Now all of you can go support Jen.
There you go. Thank you for your support,
and they'll be
everybody.
Like, Sarah's so mean. Sarah's so...
So if you're ever like, why are there kind of like
unsportive?
If you're ever like, why are there kind of random books they only mention for a second in here? I was like, it's to make a row even.
Why are there sometimes books in there that we've never mentioned?
I was like, because it's the same author and I needed that row to be even.
It's fine because we like that book or we like that person. Sometimes it sometimes it comes down to, oh, we did age gap romances and I need one more book. Do you have one that we didn't talk about? And we throw it in. So if you if you don't look at the show notes, and you should, because sometimes there's a little extra, extra present in there for you.
Sure. Or we like, or like last week with age gap, you had read the one by Saffron Kent.
Oh, I read Saffron Kent's. What's it called? 18.
Something 18. Dreams of 18.
Dreams of 18, maybe? I can't remember.
And I was like, don't worry, I'll put it in the photo array.
I'm just going to say, I mean, it was great, but also check your content warnings.
Next time, well, we have some really awesome interstitials we are planning over the next kind of month or two.
Yeah, I don't know what interstitial is next week because it won't be the one that I thought it was. So
it's fine. We'll figure it out. But
surprise, everyone.
Our next read along is going to be Whiteout by Adriana Anders,
which was also one of our picks for the best books of 2020.
Yes.
So I'm excited because I haven't read this one.
And I have, and I think it's amazing. So
I am getting ready. I'm going to get ready for Danger Bang.
Yeah, and it's going to be great because we don't do a lot of romantic suspense. And so I think it'll also be really fun for us to talk about romantic suspense.
We'll talk about that. Y'all, I hope you're reading great books this week. We are produced by Eric Mortensen. You can find a newly even grid of book covers on our website, thetamates.net. You can also find links to best friend Kelly's resistance buttons, shop for romance gear, romance stickers and pins and show notes and show paraphernalia. A lot of our episodes have pins that are in jokes for listeners. Mm-hmm. So go check those out. You can go to Jordan Denae through that website, through fadamates.net, and buy Fadamates gear. You can listen to all the music from the episodes on Faded Mates. You can see videos there. You can visit our Derek Craven Day website. You can visit our new website, which includes our friend podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Other romance novels podcast that we love. We've been revamping the website.
So check it out. All the photo arrays are even.
Yeah, if you like even things, Jen's got you covered.
All right. Have a great week, everybody.